This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Our radio show is heard on Pacifica stations nationwide, and you can watch our TV program on Free Speech TV and on our website. Intelligence agency staffers and elected officials alike are expressing shock over the promotion of White House chief strategist and one-time head of the right-wing Breitbart News, Steve Bannon, to oversee U.S. national security policy. Donald Trump has appointed Bannon to the National Security Council, which is the highest level interagency group on national security. The move comes along with demotions of the Director of National Intelligence and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. It is apparently unprecedented to have a political advisor to the president get a permanent seat at the National Security Council. Meanwhile, one of Trump's first foreign policy moves just days into his tenure was to approve a U.S. raid in Yemen that was planned many months earlier under President Obama. The raid resulted in 30 Yemenis killed, including 10 women and children. Among the dead was an 8-year-old girl who was a U.S. citizen. Nawar al-Awlaki was the younger sister of a 16-year-old U.S. citizen killed by drone strikes under Obama. My guest is Rahul Mahajan. He's the author of two books on the Iraq War, Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond, and The New Crusade, America's War on Terrorism. He's also a PhD student in sociology at the University of Wisconsin, and the U.S. Foreign Policy and Empire Correspondent for this program. Welcome back to the show, Rahul.
Great to be back with you, Sonali.
So first, let's talk about the issue of Bannon, foreign policy, national security, and what's happening on U.S. soil. There is a lot of, excitement. People are upset. They think this move to have Bannon have a seat at the National Security Council is, you know, one of the craziest things that Trump could do. Put it into context for us. How crazy is it to have Bannon at this table?
Well, it's not simply a matter of having Bannon at the table, first of all. I mean, Bannon is going to be attending the NSC principals meeting. So he's going to go to meetings at which normally, for example, under a non-Trump president, you would not include people like, say, the Deputy Secretary of Defense. All right, you'd have only the actual principal. The heads of the relevant agencies at the meeting. So he's been appointed not just to a position at the NSC, but to a central one. So it's normal to have two people of the president's staff on the National Security Council. Of course, the National Security Advisor who convenes the group and the chief of staff. Bannon is neither one of those. He is, if anything, a political consultant and strategist. And it's not normal to have them at the meetings on a regular basis, although occasionally presidents have had them. It's completely abnormal to have them on the principals committee while simultaneously demoting two of the most important members of the National Security Council, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the director of national intelligence. The DNI's removal from the council is also particularly notable because at NSC meetings, intelligence is responsible simply for providing information. They're not actually supposed to debate policy. And yet, even though his role is primarily providing information, he's been removed from regular sort of automatic attendance.
Now, Trump is justifying his presence, even though he doesn't really have the kind of experience that one would expect to have a seat at this table. He's saying, well, he was a naval officer in the 70s and 80s. Does that count for anything?
Well, it's pretty normal to have that kind of experience in one of the close personal aides, maybe like a White House chief of staff. But usually a person like that, if they've been in the military, have a better sense at least of how seriously to treat input from somebody like the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. I mean, what's going on clearly here is that I assume that the impetus for this came primarily from Bannon, is that Bannon expects to be regularly disagreeing with the recommendations of the intelligence community and of the military. And presumably, when I say disagreeing, it's not going to be in a more pacifistic direction. And he doesn't want to have to be constantly arguing with them in front of the president. If they're not there at most meetings right now, then Trump is probably not going to notice them. Most of what he notices is what's in front of his face, or actually his own face when he's watching it on TV. So Bannon, I presume, hopes to quickly become the sort of the voice of consensus on Trump's foreign policy.
What interest would someone like Bannon have in overseeing foreign policy? We know that he's been the head of Breitbart News in the past, that many have called all sorts of things from neo-Nazi to white nationalist, white supremacist. He likes to use the term alt-right. And when we sort of imagine what his approach might be, would you expect an isolationist approach or a more hawkish approach? What do you think Bannon's going to bring to this conversation?
Well, first, I think we should be a little more precise about where Bannon fits in the constellation of the right wing. So people like Richard Spencer, you know, the neo-Nazi who coined the phrase alt-right. And
the one who was punched on camera a couple of times during the inauguration?
Who was recently tragically punched on camera. They consider people like Bannon to be not real proper racist. They call them the alt-light. What Bannon is, it's actually not hard to tell because we can see transcripts of some prominent speeches he gave. In particular, I'd refer you to one from 2014. Bannon, as far as I can tell, and you know, as far as I can put a sort of coherent ideology to him, he's not so much a Hitler or a Mussolini type. He's a Francisco Franco type Catholic fascist who believes that there is a new crusade. In fact, if I can use that phrase without self-promotion, he thinks that the agenda right now for the world is a war of Christendom against Islam. If you look at that speech, he actually interprets World War II, oddly enough, as a war of Christendom against atheism, even though, of course, Nazi Germany was Christian and the most prominent proponent of atheism, the Soviet Union, was on the side of the Allies. So this is the way he sees the world. And actually, he it's hard to tell exactly where he fits on the spectrum of overt racism. In that same talk, you can actually see him saying, the Tea Party are good folks. Sometimes there are some racist militia types who join, but you can expect that in the end, they won't amount to much. So he makes the kind of normal noises that you might expect from somebody who's merely a ultra-right-wing Tea Partier who believes in a crusade against Muslims. But I think that's his core agenda. How that dovetails with what is very hard to tell is the Jared Kushner agenda. Those two things are going to make up what is the Trump foreign policy, as far as I can tell, especially since he's moved to insulate himself from any other opinions. But the Muslim ban is very clearly Bannon's first strike.
And actually, the Daily Beast last year had an article by a writer who said he had a personal conversation with Bannon, and Bannon actually described himself to this person as a Leninist. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, this is in the tradition on the right wing where you can see, for example, Grover Norquist likes to talk about this. In fact, he used to like to shock people by having a picture of Lenin, I think, in his office or his home. I can't remember the details. It starts with the fact that, you know, the American right wing actually has some roots and among ex-Trotskyists, probably the most prominent of them intellectually, a guy named James Burnham, whose work inspired the work of George Orwell and who then became one of the leading intellectual lights of the National Review in the early post-war era. So there is a certain construction of what a Leninist is that pseudo-intellectual right-wingers believe in, and mostly that involves some sort of interpretation of semi-nihilistic revolution, where we want to destroy this system and we're going to do it in as clever and strategic a way as we can, and we're happy to do it with a small coterie of people who have little concern for what the public actually thinks. I think when they say Leninist, that's about as far as I would really take it analytically.
So, Rahul, let's talk about what the U.S. has been up to on the foreign policy front. I mentioned the raid that was accompanied by Predator drone strikes in Yemen, and Trump did acknowledge that the U.S. had some casualties, but made no mention of the Yemeni casualties, and it wasn't until the Yemeni government, or Yemeni authorities, rather, made noise about 30 people being killed. That was then confirmed by press that we know that there were serious civilian casualties. This is a country that it's already been bombarded by the U.S.'s major ally, Saudi Arabia, with U.S. help. And the U.S. even before that had been dropping individual drone strikes. It killed Anwar al-Awlaki under President Obama, a U.S. Citizen and a cleric who was reportedly fomenting agitation against the U.S. Then in a separate strike killed this man's 16-year-old child, a U.S. citizen. And now his second child, an 8-year-old girl, has reportedly been killed. We're not hearing very much in the U.S. press about this. Why is that?
Well, in part, I think it just takes a little bit while for the media to dig in after the Pentagon comes up with its, you know, very brazen statements about what really happened. I mean, my goodness, you could hear the oddly named Captain Jeff Davis, Pentagon spokesman, saying that the reason women were killed was that they were Al-Qaeda fighters. Now, you know, I wasn't there at the house they were raiding, so I can't definitively say that was not the case, but I've never ever heard of such a thing. I mean, even when I was in Iraq and when it was routine to search everyone for weapons, when the group I went into Fallujah with got searched by U.S. soldiers before we went in, they didn't frisk the women. There was an understanding by that point, after early outrage about U.S. soldiers frisking women, that women were not going to be used to even carry weapons, let alone be fighters. I've never heard of any such thing as a female Al-Qaeda fighter in my life. But as soon as there's a drone strike and somebody says women were killed, you know, the brazenness of the Pentagon, of course, which will presumably reach new heights in the Trump era, is fully on display. I think that we'll see a little bit of better reporting as anyone manages to dig into the story. And it's already being clearly reported that Anwar al-Awlaki's 8-year-old daughter was in fact killed, which was at first being reported simply as a claim by Al-Qaeda. Now the media has followed up on it. I mean, it's quite, whatever you think about the extrajudicial assassination of Anwar al-Awlaki, who surely was actually fomenting, terrorism against the United States. And personally, obviously, I think it was a completely illegal act, as is the entire drone strike operation. The attitude of first the Obama administration and now the Trump administration to the unintentional, in the sense of untargeted, killing of two of his children has been just phenomenally callous and amazing. And the only thing I guess that's surprising about the level of callousness is that we're talking about U.S. citizens, because of course we're well used to this callousness when it comes to others. But in terms of the raid, I mean, it was fairly normal. It's the kind of thing that Obama might well have signed off on.
So we'll see a sort of continuum between Obama and Trump, at least where countries like Yemen are concerned.
I think that was the signal that was sent. I mean, I'm sure that the Trump people were hoping that they would have some sort of heroics they could trumpet with an actual raid, but instead it's a bit of a botched operation with an American soldier being killed as well. Traditionally, we've seen a greater willingness of Republican administrations to put boots on the ground and people at risk than of Democratic ones. But Trump is, of course, a wild card in this regard, and it's hard to say whether that's going to, you know, hold true.
Speaking of recasting women and even children as potential threats, the so-called Muslim ban here in the United States that is targeting nationals of 7 countries, most if not all of which the U.S. has at one point bombed, even children are being seen as suspicious. We're seeing reports at airports where children as young as 2 and 5 are being detained, and the Trump administration has basically responded saying that even children can be considered suspicious. Now, Rahul, Iraq has responded. Iraq's government, of course, installed by the U.S., supported by the U.S., is supposed to be a U.S. ally. The Iraq government is very angry at being on the list of countries whose nationals are prevented from traveling to the U.S. on valid visas. And the Iraq has said that it could have a reciprocal ban on American citizens. Is Trump, through these racist policies here in the U.S., going to make a big mess of U.S. foreign policy?
Well, I mean, in a way, that was the idea. I mean, it's a very weird group of countries, and apparently it is a legacy of a particular Obama-era regulation. But including Iran means that, and I'm sure that the Trump people did not think through this very much, means that it affects a large number of scientists, academic researchers, the kind of people that a normal administration wouldn't want to hamper in their work in the United States in the way that they have done. It's affecting nearly every major university here. It's affecting not only the actual countries involved, and countries even which often seem to be under the thumb of the United States are very willing to reciprocate bans or visa impositions that the United States puts on them. That's sort of routine in international diplomacy. So we may well see that happen. But it's also done in a way to disrupt everything else. They're disrupting traffic at airports around the world. They are affecting everyone, including the global elite business class, most of which, unlike Trump, doesn't fly everywhere in private jets. They simply fly business class in the same planes and through the same airports, where everything is now being terribly disrupted. And it's one thing to have this ban, which is bad enough, but to implement it and actually sort of very aggressively go beyond it, the way a whole large number of enforcement agents are doing, is, I mean, they're doing it to such a remarkable degree that one wonders how many of these people were simply waiting for the opportunity to inflict themselves on anybody they could, or also if there was some guidance given. I mean, again, it's one thing to have this ban, and it's another thing to hold a 5-year-old for hours alone, presumably questioning him hard about what plots he might have against the United States, or what, you know, his previous courses of study had been, what were his expertise in engineering, you know, did he know he could dirty bomb, or whatever it was they questioned him. It's pretty remarkable.
Right, people are being held without food in some instances. Also, people whose origin, country of origin, is not on the list of seven. The Mexican nationals being held very, very disruptive. I mean, essentially, Trump wanted to be the disruptor in chief, and that's essentially what he has become so soon into his tenure. Rahul, I know we're going to need your voice on this program now more than ever. We'll have you back on again in the future. Thanks so much.
Look forward to it. Thanks for having me.
Rahul Mahajan is the author of two books on the Iraq War, Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond, and The New Crusade, America's War on Terrorism. He's also a PhD student in sociology at the University of Wisconsin, and he's the U.S. foreign policy and empire correspondent for this program. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can sign up for our newsletter at risingupwithsonali.com to get daily emails with links to all our shows.